Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, Healthcare and Abortion, Afghanistan and the alleged Fort Hood killer in the news this week. Major Nidal Hassan, formally charged. He could face the death penalty.
U.S. Army Major Nidal Malik Hassan, a 39-year-old psychiatrist assigned to Darnell Medical Center here at Fort Hood, has been charged with 13 specifications of premeditated murder.
President Obama wants better options on Afghanistan. He spoke today from Japan.
I don't think this is a matter of some datum of information that I'm waiting on. It's a matter of making certain that when I send young men and women into war, and I devote billions of dollars of U.S. taxpayer money, that it's making us safer.
And the House passes health care reform, but abortion takes over. Michigan Democratic Congressman Bart Stupak co-sponsored a bill that bans public funding.
Let us stand together on principle of no public funding for abortion, no public funding for insurance policies that pay for abortion. Stand with us, protect our role, and let's keep current law.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. Give us your thoughts on Major Hassan, on Afghanistan now, on abortion in the healthcare debate. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me today in the studio is Ellen Goodman, nationally syndicated columnist for the Boston Globe. Ellen, great to have you here.
Thank you.
And in the studio, David Gergen, director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He served as advisor to Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. David Gergen, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack. Is it snowing up there yet, Jack?
Not yet, all but. Hi, Tom, Ellen, and David.
It's great to have you all. I want to look first at the Fort Hood killings and the aftermath of that, the sort of a very fast week of shock and then grief and then unsettling information that's come out about this officer in the U.S. Army. Speaking Tuesday at the memorial service at Fort Hood, President Obama spoke of Major Hassan. He was unambiguous of his own judgment.
It may be hard to comprehend the twisted logic that led to this tragedy. But this much we do know. No faith justifies these murderous and craven acts. No just and loving God looks upon them with favor. For what he has done, we know that the killer will be met with justice in this world and the next.
In this world and the next, or the next, it sounds like Braveheart or something. But this is real grief, and those were real helmets empty. They're a very unusual sight, Ellen, on the stage at Fort Hood, Texas. We associate that with distant deserts these days, not with home turf. What do you see as the takeaway from this story at the end of this week of shock, then grief, then everything we've learned?
Well, of course, the visual image of the helmets and on the bayonets was really very, very striking. And it is. I mean, it's the most unexpected casualty to happen at home.
And so many.
And from a psychiatrist. How many ways do you look at it that it just seems unbelievably unique that the psychiatrist went nuts, you know? And, of course, everybody sort of instantly tries to put some grid of meaning over a story that is very hard to find meaning. There's a lot of backstory now that we know that we can say in 2020 hindsight should have raised flags, but there's also a lot of reason to understand why it just kept being passed along.
Right on down the line, one judgment was made, and pretty early on, by Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, chairman of the Homeland Security Committee, said on Fox News on Sunday that there was serious concern that the Fort Hood massacre, well, he called it a terrorist act.
If the reports that we're receiving of various statements he made, acts he took, are valid, he had turned to Islamist extremism. And therefore, if that is true, the murder of these 13 people was a terrorist act. And in fact, it was the most destructive terrorist act to be committed on American soil since 9/11.
Joe Lieberman this week. David Gergen, here we have Major Hassan, 13 dead, many more wounded. The incredible stories there. And then the news comes out that he'd been in email contact with this radical Muslim cleric, Anwar al-Awlaki, American in Yemen. And the Army didn't even know about it. The FBI did. I mean, this is a tough thing to stare at and try and figure out. Where do you see the bottom line here?
Well, it struck me. I echo much of what Ellen just said. It's hard to find an ultimate meaning here, but it did seem to me to be a very dark cloud with some silver linings. The horrific nature of the killing, but was accompanied also by heroic acts of people who moved in to stop him. That I thought the country's response was very restrained and responsible. Well, there was not a lot of anti-Muslim feeling in the country. We didn't see a flare up in that, which I thought was extremely good. But by the end of the week, I think we were coming increasingly to the view this is indeed a terrorist act or appears to be a terrorist act, and we are acting appropriately. I found one of the interesting and curious events of the week right at the end when the federal government moved to seize and file papers to seize not only an office building in Manhattan but a mosque in Texas.
It's owned by Iran.
Owned by Iran. And whether and accusing that of being used for money laundering and money going into the Iranian pockets for terrorist purposes, and it was hard to understand. Is this related to Fort Hood? Is it related to the negotiations, or potential breakdown, or a possible breakdown in the negotiations with Iran? What is this all linked to? What's the larger meaning of that? I think there are a number of question marks at the end of the week that we have, but I must say, I thought the president's remarks and the restraint shown by the country, we didn't see this kind of Muslim outrage or anti-Muslim outrage that might have come.
Watch this space on the tower in Manhattan and the mosque in Virginia, I guess. But Jack, on the Fort Hood killings, massacre, I mean, in the interest of national solidarity, there's a powerful impulse to kind of mute and singularize what went on here, but not everybody's following that impulse. I mean, Joe Lieberman's ready to call it terrorism. There are calls to look into why there wasn't more investigation, whether there was too much political correctness in the handling of this obviously very troubled man.
Yes. On the terrorism front, Bruce Hoffman, the terrorism expert at Georgetown, he talks about what he calls leaderless resistance, a kind of, where Al-Qaeda sort of motivates individuals to act without direct orders and sort of free-floating terrorism. The trouble with that definition, of course, is it defines terrorism down to almost just exchanging emails with somebody in Yemen. Was this terrorism? I resist it just simply because of its capacity to freeze thinking and to mobilize fear, and because it may be Occam's razor may make it unnecessary. We have heard from his Daniel Zwerdling's reporting that on NPR that his psychiatric colleagues at Walter Reed thought that he perhaps showed symptoms of psychosis. He clearly was inflamed with jihadist rhetoric of various kinds. But what was the primary motive? Was it this psychosis? Was it this alienation? Was it? We really don't know, and I think that we need to resist rushing to judgment there. And on the question of the handling of it, I mean, right at the center, you mentioned it, Tom. The FBI knew about these contacts with the sheikh in Yemen and did not tell the Defense Department. Now, this is a repeat of the worst feature of the lead up to 9/11, when the CIA wasn't communicating with the FBI and vice versa. When are they going to get this straightened out?
Of course, even within the Army, there was a lot of knowledge that wasn't exactly turned into action. He was, in a way, fobbed off to Fort Hood. Daniel Zwerdling of NPR did a lot of great reporting on this week. Here's just a bit of the picture that he began to help lay before the country.
When I ask people to describe Hassan, they keep using the same words. It's interesting. Disconnected, aloof, a loner, belligerent, and sometimes super polite. Well, then in January 2008, Hassan turned in a paper that really got people worried because they thought it was basically a disjointed religious diatribe, and some key officials sat around wondering, could he be descending into psychosis?
There you go. Could he be? Ellen Goodman?
Well, I mean, you have a scenario here, which is kind of the crazy person at the office scenario. which is that a lot of people tiptoed around him, didn't talk to him. An alienated person was increasingly alienated, but no one also called him. No one also, they did just keep passing him along. I mean, in a sense, it's like the scenario of somebody who goes what we call postal.
Mm-hmm.
It's not all that different, except that, of course, it has all these, Muslim undertone and the terrorist undertone, and of course that it ended up in this kind of a tragedy at Mount Hood. But there is, if you took that scene of people walking around the crazy person at the office, passing him on from one department to another until it was a disaster happened, it would be something that's replicated a lot.
But this, in an army, that David Gergen, that wants to, needs to embrace its Muslim members. They're an important part of this force, an important part of this country.
Absolutely. And General Casey, as a chief of staff of the Army, made it very clear that the Army was going to continue to embrace its 3,000 Muslim members or so, as it should. After all, I imagine a lot of these people also bring a language understandings to the Army, which is really important. But to go back to Jack's point, Jack, I don't quite understand why if someone is suffering from psychosis, that it does not mean he's a terrorist as well. I imagine a lot of the people...
The line becomes very fuzzy there.
Absolutely. I imagine a lot of the people at 9/11 who had, you know, stole airplanes and ran them into buildings, killing a lot of people, suffered from psychosis too. They were still terrorists.
Jack?
Yes, unquestionably. But, you know, there you had a cabal. There you had a conspiracy. You had people acting in concert for political ends to you know, mobilize fear in the United States. This seems to be, everything we read, this is one man.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, more debate on Afghanistan, on the Fort Hood killer, on health care and abortion. Ellen Goodman, nationally syndicated columnist for the Boston Globe, is with us today, as is David Gergen, author of Eyewitness to Power. He was advisor to Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, Clinton. Jack Beatty is with us. Let's get a call from Montreal. And Ahmed, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I just wanted to say, because we're using the term a lot, radical imam, for the Imam Anwar that they're saying the killer,
yes,
the killer was contacting.
Mm-hmm.
This imam, he's very, very popular. He has a very nice series on lives of the prophets from Adam to Jesus. He has a series on the hereafter. Just contacting an imam or sending emails to him doesn't make a person do something like that. In Islam, you're not allowed to kill an innocent person, and it's very clear. A self-defense situation would be different, but you're not killing one innocent person in Islam is like killing all humanity, and saving one human being is like saving all humanity.
I mean, we want to know and to respect that. At the same time, some of the reporting that's come out on this particular cleric shows him as a fairly angry man in some circumstances. I mean, it's
yes, I think there's some issues because there are several war fronts right now in Muslim countries. Afghanistan and Iraq and Palestine. So I'm sure you understand that people who feel that they're being attacked, they feel the need also to defend themselves.
And that may take us, you know, right to the point. It seems to be what people were hearing from Major Hassan, that exactly that kind of struggle. Ahmed, thanks for your call. Let's get one from Des Moines, Iowa. Mickey, you're on the air.
Hello, and thanks for taking my call. My question is, why have we not heard more from the Muslim community denouncing this activity and supporting America if this religion truly does not believe that a just and loving God would approve such action? I'd like to hear that vocalized more than I have.
Mickey, we've got it, and thanks for your call. Now, I have to say I have heard from any number of Muslim sources through this week exactly that sentiment. It may be hard for them to rise above at this moment the grief and the questions. But, Ellen, it's not as though we see an American Muslim community pointing the other way here.
No, I think we have. I think there has been a lot of conversation from the Muslim community. And also, to be honest, it affects other Muslims in the military horribly. They're tainted.
No fun to be in their shoes right now.
No fun.
We hope not tainted.
Yeah, I may be wrong about this, but I thought that the mosque where Hassan worshipped, has issued a statement denouncing this act. I don't think it's gotten enough attention in the press, but I do think that the mosque itself, where he worshipped, has been very strong and vigorous in its denunciation.
And people who were interviewed from that mosque were also saying, whoa, that he was off the rails.
That mosque and elsewhere around the country. But you feel Mickey sort of wanting to hear that and the hunger for that. Let's get a call from here's one, Charleston, South Carolina. Matthew, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I just wanted to make a comment about I listen to conservative talk radio every once in a while just to sort of hear what they're saying, and I hear a tendency of them wanting to immediately almost belligerently label this terrorism, and I don't think we know enough facts to actually label it that, but it seems as though because this guy is obviously Muslim and possibly had uttered the words God is great, seems to me that to them that's obviously terrorism. I don't see how those two things are synonymous. I think with the information we know at this time, it seems as though this guy was to a certain degree psychotic. And that's all we can say. And obviously he was Muslim, but I don't see how that equates to terrorism.
Right. David Gergen, I mean, we were reminded last week by a friend from Dallas that Killeen had saw another horrific killing in the early 90s, Killeen, Texas, and, you know, just somebody in a pickup truck ramming through a cafe window. And it's not as though it requires this particular circumstance or this man or this religion to have that happen. Americans have seen that again and again. Yet people want to be clear-eyed about this. This is deep in our military.
Yeah, I think the caller is right that conservatives have been quick to call this Hassan a terrorist. I guess I'm puzzled why the left is so hesitant to call him a terrorist. After all, there is plenty. I mean, the eyewitness accounts of him standing on a table and
with
yelling
the guns.
God, with the guns, yelling "God is great." Mm-hmm. We associate very strongly with someone who is, who's perpetrating violence, and in the name of a fanaticism. And so why this reluctance? Why this hesitation to call him a terrorist? I mean, we ought to call it the way it is, as you say.
Jack, this is a case where you've got to hold the scalpel very carefully. It requires a certain kind of equanimity here to see what's there, not assume more than is there, and at the same time hold together our national and army solidarity.
I think that's right. And the problem, David, I think with going to terrorism is that it immediately you think of a plot and you think of other people involved in it. And
but Jack, you just told us a few minutes ago that the Army should have, I mean, the FBI should have alerted the Army.
Oh,
as
indeed,
if there
it
was
should
evidence,
have.
If there were signals that he was conspiring or had communications that should have put them on the alert. That suggests to me you think that he was somehow encouraged and that the FBI should have reported that.
There's another issue, which is clearly the killer, although we haven't heard from him. We've begun... Mm-hmm. He put his own act in the context of his own religious conflicts between mm-hmm. being Muslim. He defined it that way. So then it's interesting because maybe what's happening is we don't want to accept his definition, and we're more comfortable by saying he's a crazy person. You know,
that could be. Certainly, nobody wants to drag
because once you say yes, it's connected to his religion, then there is the feeling that you are tainting every other Muslim in the military or out of it.
So we
prefer to put, in a sense, a secular.
But do we
accept her? Yes. Do we accept his own definition of what he did? I'm speaking quickly because we're piecing together what he believes from. We haven't heard from him. Obviously.
We're going to have to make distinctions as a country that are very, very important here about what's singular and what's not.
You know, and according to today's Times, the information, the emails he was getting from Yemen were fairly anodyne. They weren't, I don't know whether they're inflammatory as a word or not, but they were answering questions he had about various things. They weren't apparently on their face inciting.
Right, though there's been plenty of reporting that Imam Aliki, could be pretty inciting at other times. Let me get a call from Toronto and Jack. Jack, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Just a comment and a question. I think that on Afghanistan, NATO is slowly unraveling because of the hesitancy by the Obama administration to either you know, commit more troops or get out of there. I mean, it's a deeply unpopular war in places like Germany or up here in Canada. So I think it's the burden sharing is being stretched to the limits, and a time for some decisive action is necessary. And just a quick question to your distinguished panel. I know that Yemen has been singled out and Iran for possible ties to the Fort Hood massacre, but couldn't there be a Saudi Arabian link to these shootings?
Well, I mean, I think we have no idea at this point, and that's where we want to be careful about speculation. But let us do go to your Afghanistan point, and David Gergen, to you. This is huge right now. Ambassador Eikenberry, former general who's ambassador to Afghanistan, his memo's coming back and very publicly made public by the White House this week, urging caution on more troops there, despite what General McChrystal has asked for, and President Obama still with his foot on the clutch, not making that decision yet. Jack says the strain's getting to be too much. Where's the balance here?
We're dealing with complicated questions this week, aren't we? Mm-hmm.
This and every week, it seems lately.
That's right. I think most Americans, especially in the progressive side, appreciate the fact that the president is being very deliberate, asking a lot of questions, and that the left has believed for some time that some former presidents, including our last one and including Lyndon Johnson, and even Jack Kennedy, should have taken more time before committing troops to places like Iraq and Vietnam. Having said that, and I think the deliberative approach is right, I don't think anybody ever expected that the deliberative approach would be stretched this long. The White House itself was saying earlier this fall that we would have decisions by November. The Prime Minister Gordon Brown told Parliament that he expected a final decision in the next couple of days, thinking everybody thought that decisions would be made in the meeting this week. The prolonging of this process, and now I think the egregious leaking that has gone on. Secretary Gates himself yesterday said he was appalled by the leaks. I think he spoke properly. Has created a growing sense of a Hamlet-like president who is can't quite make up his mind. And I will tell you, I think the longer this goes on, the more it will undermine confidence in the ultimate decision he does make. There's an increasing sense that he feels he doesn't have any good options.
And so
whatever he embraces, how much confidence are you going to have in it? It's hard to rally people to fight a war with a muted trumpet. It is, if you're going to say charge, and then say, well, maybe we should just do a little bit of this, maybe, hey, why don't we charge? That hardly stirs the blood and gets a country committed, and nor does it bring NATO allies into it.
But then, Ellen, in the same week, we saw Eikenberry saying, no, don't do this until we have a...
Exactly, and I'm not sure what we need now is a rallying cry of charge either. I'm not saying that I think that you have to be realistic about a set of really ghastly options that we're running.
What parents do you know would want to lose a child under a cause that is so sort of murky and nobody knows whether it's going to work or not? If we're going to commit to pulling it off.
But that's the reality. It is murky and we don't think it can work.
Well, then why are we going to commit a lot of troops to it?
Well, that's the question. I really think, as his books reveal, the president's a man of moral feeling and restless intelligence, and you see both these qualities at work now. And, you know, he's been among the war's casualties. Just consider it. He's been keeping a wee hours vigil for dead soldiers at Dover Air Force Base, speaking this week at Fort Hood at the Tomb of the Unknown, and then to mourners at Section 60 of the cemetery where the dead
Arlington.
Of Iraq and Afghanistan are buried. And then and then last night in Anchorage, he stops to talk to the parents of a dead Marine, a Native American killed in Afghanistan. You know, I don't think it's a coincidence that he went directly from Arlington Cemetery to the meeting where he said, I want new options, scale back and with a way out, with a path out. According to the Post, he's losing weight, missing meals, feeling every ounce of the burden of decision on his shoulders. He palpably wants to do the right thing by those whom he has said have sacrificed so much and are willing to sacrifice more, but not for a cause for which his party, for which a near majority of the people, and perhaps the president himself, have lost faith.
And yet it's not just a hypothetical. There are real security issues here. We'll look at them. Ellen Goodman, we get this report from Afghanistan that you had this week. You know, General, now Ambassador Eikenberry, who commanded forces there in the room, General McChrystal, who wants 40,000 more troops in the room, and a real kind of standoff with McChrystal ultimately, you know, saying, look, you're not putting anything on the table here besides, quote, the helicopter on the roof of the embassy, unquote, scenario, saying, what do you want, just to pull out like we did from Vietnam? Is that the option?
It's a nightmare, and it's an inherited nightmare. And one of the pieces of this story that I've been following is the story of Afghan women that I started following in 1998 mm-hmm. when we first got the, not first, but when we got reports of women in burqas, you know, who were
deep under
basically
the heel of the Taliban.
Under house arrest.
Mm-hmm.
And when we went into Afghanistan, one of the moral goods that was supposed to come out of that was the liberation of the Afghan women, and George Bush came up and talked about it, and that's one of the moral grids that we have put over this. And then you fast forward, and have we simply replaced, say, the Taliban with the warlords? Yes, women's lives got better, but also...
Are you ready to walk away from those women?
So you have a situation where do you walk away from half of the population and leave them to the Taliban again? Do you, on the other hand, support a president who's not all that much... I mean, he is better, but not...
Hamid Karzai with his clear corruption and all the rest.
Right. And do you endanger our own soldiers for the sake of hope rather than results of what could be in Afghanistan? Hamlet didn't have enough hands for this one.
Hey, David Gergen, hold the thought, if you would. Let me get one call from Nashville and Randy. Randy, you're on the air.
Tom, thank God Obama's taking his time. We've had 60 years of our leaders trying to rally the troops and getting our blood to boil so we'd fight. Thank God we've got somebody there now who's willing to think about this and take his time before he commits American lives to lost causes.
Randy, thanks for your call. David Gergen, what do you say to that?
Absolutely. It's clear that the president needs to take time to do this. But there is also such a thing as paralysis by analysis. Our great presidents have been able to make decisions after a reasonable period of time on weighty issues. Abraham Lincoln had to weigh the heaviest issues. But eventually there comes a time to decide. That's what the job of presidents is. And if you're going to decide, you have to decide either you're going in or you're not going in. But if you're going in, go in to succeed. Do not go put American troops on the line in a cause that you're not quite sure you believe in.
What do you make of this White House picture, David? You've been there. I mean, this week, Veterans Day, we have the report that Secretary Gates and Admiral Mike Mullen, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and Hillary Clinton are reportedly coalescing about a proposal to send 30,000 or more troops there. Right. Here's the president not. Here's Eikenberry not. Is this unusually disparate array of opinion?
That's why I think these leaks have done no service to the President of the United mm-hmm. States. They have set the President up in a situation where he seems to be increasingly having to decide among, in a deeply divided administration. That sends a signal to others that when he comes down one way or the other, there's substantial dissent within his own administration. That does not encourage confidence that he'll stick to the decision for the long haul. That only, especially if he's going to, I think he's going to, he signaled he's going to put some more troops in there. Mm-hmm. We don't know whether it's 10, 20, 30, 40. He signaled that he's going to ask NATO allies to do that. Well, to get people to go do that, you have to do it with a certain sense of conviction. And if you've got people all around you dissent, and it's well known, it really makes it very messy for the president. I feel sorry for him. He pledged yesterday at Elmendorf he would rally the public behind him on this. He pledged to the troops, we'll have your back. Mm-hmm. I'll rally the public. It becomes very hard when your own people are dissenting, and the whole public and the whole world knows it. I think the people who've leaked this have done a real disservice.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news, D.C. sniper John Allen Muhammad, who terrorized Washington suburbs in 2002, was executed by lethal injection in Virginia on Tuesday. Prison spokesman Larry Traylor.
There were no complications. Mr. Muhammad was asked if he wished to make a last statement. He did not acknowledge this or make any statement whatsoever.
Elizabeth Lambert, the ponytail pulling takedown college soccer player, had everyone talking this week, including soccer Olympian Julie Foudy.
Oh my goodness, if you're going to pull someone's ponytail and about snap their head off with it, that is going over the line.
That was some kind of video, and Sesame Street turned 40. We could use a sunny song.
Sunny day, sleeping up.
I don't know about that, Sonny, but for the kids, for the kids. We're looking at a week in the news, debate on Afghanistan, on the Fort Hood killer, on health care and abortion. David Gergen is with us in the studio today. So is Ellen Goodman, nationally syndicated columnist for the Boston, with the Boston Globe. Jack Beatty's here. Let's hear just a little bit. This is Representative Congressman Joe Pitts, Republican from Pennsylvania, defending the amendment he co-sponsored with Bart Stupak, Democrat of Michigan, that would prohibit abortion funding in the public option.
Under this bill, funds will flow from premium payments and affordability credits into the U.S. Treasury account, and that account will then reimburse for abortion services. Every dollar in the public option is a federal dollar. Let me be clear. If the government plan covers abortion, that amounts to federal funding for abortion. It's that simple. Our amendment would maintain the principles of the Hyde Amendment, something that the large majority of Americans support.
And here's Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, Democrat of Connecticut, in the debate on the House floor, saying the amendment that ended up in the House bill is overly restrictive.
It prohibits them from access to an abortion, even if they pay for it with their own money. It invades women's personal decisions, discriminates against working women, and put simply, violates the law of the land.
David Gergen, Ellen Goodman, Jack, I want to hear from you on this, but first from our listeners, Joe, Columbia, South Carolina. You're on the air, Joe.
Yes. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I just wonder, I just don't understand for the life of me, why so many bills that Congress tried to pass, that the Catholic bishops or the conservatives or the right to life or whoever you want to call them, have to throw abortion into the mix in the first place. I mean, we're trying to get everybody covered for health care concern, and here they come throwing abortion into the mix again. It's not the first time they've done this, you know. They've done this on other bills, too, in the past.
We've seen it.
What's going on with this?
Well, I mean, people hold it dear, and there it is right in the middle of this bill. Joe, thanks. Let me get one more. La Vista, Nebraska. Patty, you're on the air, Patty.
Yes, I'd like to start out saying I do not support abortion. However, I see that the same people who are saying we don't want the government between us and our doctors are saying, with this bill, we've got to have the government between us and our doctors.
Yes, in a way, you're right, Patty. Thank you for that. Ellen, here I've got from our website, Jonathan writes, he said, I saw the GOP, this is the Republican National Committee I think he's referring to, dropped coverage for elective abortions from its own health coverage for its own employees. So is the Stupak abortion amendment an attempt to change the health care debate into an abortion debate? Jonathan asks, I certainly hope the health care debate doesn't devolve into the even more divisive issue of abortion. Ellen, are we there?
Well, they did start out, and just for the call, they started out trying to get abortion off the table. Everybody had agreed, okay, we're going to keep the status quo
here. Abortion neutral was the phrase.
This was going to be an abortion neutral bill. And then the biggest player in this were the Catholic bishops, who came in and said, no, we're not doing neutral here.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have this whole bill hang on whether there's any money in it at all that could be used even privately for abortions. And this is the Catholic bishops who have been extremely in favor of universal health care were willing to deep six it on this ground.
Mm-hmm.
And their intransigence changed the playing field of this. At the last minute, there was everything was abandoned in Congress. And
a lot of Democrats voting for this bill with the
restrictions.
A lot of Democrats
ended up having to choose between deep-sixing the bill altogether or getting it out with something that they were not in favor of, which is an anti-abortion provision.
Clause right in the middle of it.
Right in the heart of it. Now it's going to back to the Senate, and there's a good deal of an uproar about it still, whether it will end up out of conference committee in the actual bill or not. It's not something that's necessarily going to redound very well to the to the Catholic bishops themselves either. I mean, they at the moment have won this round, but they may not win the whole story, particularly in the minds even of their own constituents.
I mean, I guess that depends where you stand on abortion. David Gergen, I mean, what a complicated moral and political calculus here. Even for anti-abortion people, they have to decide, well, we're going to put that ahead of fundamental health coverage for people, and then we go to the Senate with the notion that this may be worked out, but it may not.
It's been an agony for Democrats in particular because there's a growing firestorm now among pro-choice groups. This abortion issue could ultimately torpedo the health bill altogether. It's very complicated. I think we ought to go back to fundamentals. Mm-hmm. The for some years, for better or for worse, and many people think for worse, probably listen to this, we've had a bill or a law in this country called the Hyde Amendment, which has said that the federal government would not, no federal money would help to pay for abortions. Now, how are you going to do that if you expand the insurance coverage for 39 million people or so? So what happens to the abortion question? Well, the provision that was put in there in the Senate to deal with this, to make sure that there was that we didn't violate the Hyde Amendment, the Catholic Church and a lot of pro-lifers see as in fact is going to provide indirect subsidies, indirect federal assistance,
fungible cash
and the like. And they came up with then what's now called the Stupak Amendment, which really says if you're a poor woman and go in and buy a plan under this new exchange that is partially subsidized,
public exchange
that is subsidized by the federal government because you can't pay for it otherwise, your insurance plan cannot include coverage for abortion, that you would have to go and buy out of your own pocket a rider. And it's widely believed by pro-choice people that poor women are not going to buy a plan for an insurance policy for an unplanned abortion. They won't buy it.
Anybody. Who counts on having an abortion?
Exactly. And we don't even know if the insurance companies will provide the rider. Mm-hmm. So
assume that any insurance company that wants to go into the exchange would eventually drop abortion coverage
for the private sector, for
all subsidies. So I started out thinking that the Stupak Amendment probably sounded like a status quo amendment. The more I've looked at it, the more I believe that the Stupak Amendment, if adopted, would actually diminish the number of women who have access to abortion through insurance, and that it would reduce the rights of women in that sense. And therefore, I understand why the pro-choice people are up in arms about this.
Jack, do you see a torpedo headed at the whole reform effort in the body of this abortion amendment?
It could well be. If the Senate rejects this, Representative Stupak says that he will lead his band, or as many of them will follow him, to vote against the whole bill when it comes to if it comes back to the House without his amendment. You know, Ellen mentioned the Catholic bishops and the pressure they put on members here. What sort of pressure? Consider Patrick Kennedy, the Rhode Island congressman, son of late Senator Kennedy. Mm. His bishop, Thomas Tobin, threatened to deny him Holy Communion for his vote against Stupak, and he said that Kennedy's support of abortion rights, quote, was a deliberate and obstinate act of the will. You know, Bishop Tobin may not realize it, but he is unwittingly reviving there the canard that helped defeat Al Smith in 1928, the canard that Catholic politicians can't be free agents, that they surrender their wills to bishops. John F. Kennedy answered that charge during the 1960 campaign in Houston, addressing the Protestant clergyman, when he said, America is a nation where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no Catholic prelate would tell the president how to act, no Protestant minister tell his parishioners for whom to vote. He added, I am not the Catholic candidate for president. I do not speak for the church in public matters. The church does not speak for me. That's the voice of American pluralism, a declaration of freedom of conscience. And you wonder, does Bishop Tobin? Do the bishops in general think that non-Catholics would vote for a politician who could be bullied by a bishop who surrendered his conscience to the authority of the church?
David Ellen, is that on the table here as well?
Well, I think you have to say that this kerfuffle between the bishop and Kennedy is very telling. But in fact, Catholics support abortion, are as pro-choice as any other part of the body politic.
Though not in the ranks of bishops, certainly.
No. Well, but I mean, what the bishops are doing is alienating
maybe
other people who consider themselves Catholic as much as anything. They're saying you can't be Catholic you can't be a Catholic politician, and you can't identify yourself as such, whether you're Nancy Pelosi or Patrick Kennedy, unless you are opposed to abortion. That's not a good long-term strategy.
I think it's Donna Brazile told me yesterday, the Democratic strategist, that she counted it up, and there were some 90 Catholics in the House of Representatives. Only about one-third of them voted for the Stupak Amendment, which was striking. Yeah. It supports Ellen's point that the Catholic population, in fact, in practicing.
But that was enough.
That's right. But look, I think one has to be very, very careful about going after people for their religious beliefs. The Catholics are acting out of a very deep-seated sense of religion. There are deep divisions in this country about issues like this. I would hope that we could settle these issues without sort of going. We have a vigorous debate over the merits, but be very careful about not attacking others.
Yeah, that debate has been.
You have to be careful that you have to remember one of the things that I was really struck by was Cardinal O'Malley's blog after Ted Kennedy's funeral, and in that
he'd been criticized.
And in that blog, he'd been criticized just for being at the funeral
because of Ted Kennedy's position on abortion,
Senator.
Right?
And he called for civility on that, but then he said, "By the way, I used the funeral to lobby the President of the United States," which is about as unseemly an act at a funeral as you get to. So I think that doesn't really in the long run sit well with their own population.
And this, an issue that debate has never settled, at least not yet. Let's get a call from Lowell, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How are you?
Very well. What do you see, David?
I've been a very long-time supporter of pro-choice movements, and what I really see coming down the pike, there's either weak support or really no support or no vocal support for it anymore.
For what, David?
For pro-choice and for maintaining a woman's right, basically over her own body.
Mm.
When you look at the voting patterns over the past 10 years, it's been increasingly conservative, and it's very frustrating that the women of the United States aren't standing up for themselves. What's tragic about this is it may torpedo the health care bill, and basically at this point, I'm just so frustrated with that whole issue. If it means banning abortion but passing the health care bill, I guess that's what we have to do. I think it's incumbent upon the women of the country to stand up and finally end this debate.
But by letting go their right, you're saying, as
well,
it stands up for health care.
Not necessarily doing that, but defending their right and demanding via protest or whatever means necessary that they keep something in the bill that protects their rights to their own bodies.
I guess that is the hope of those who would support that. Let me get one more call here. Beverly, Aaron, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just had a quick comment. I mean, it seems to me that the goal of a Christian lifestyle, I mean, I'm a Christian myself, is to prevent suffering. I mean, I can understand anti-abortion stance, but can we focus on the amount of suffering going on because we don't have universal health care right now? Because, I mean, how much suffering is going on right now? How many people are dying because they can't afford, certain treatments or access to doctors? I mean, it just seems ludicrous that we're derailing the whole process. Because of one issue.
Yeah, Aaron, we've got it. It's been a big and tough issue. And Ellen, you heard Aaron and David earlier saying maybe this right is slipping away here in the midst of the bigger conversation about health care and generally.
Well, we have. We have taken it away from Medicaid coverage in most states through the Hyde Amendment. Then we took the access to the right the payment, at least, or the reimbursement, mm-hmm. which is, in a sense, the legitimization of abortion, so that a woman in the military can't get an abortion even with her own money on a military base, even if she, you know, whatever the
circumstances. And here's the Republican National Committee taking it out of the private insurance that their employees have reportedly.
Then the Republicans discovered it was in their health care policy at the Republican National Committee, and they removed it from that. So this is step by step. There's an incremental removal of access and of payment. Now, what happens if women don't have access to reimbursement? They have later abortions. They use more of their own money. I mean, step by step, you start cutting back access and then the right and to have a legal procedure.
David, do you see a compromise here?
I there has to be language that is consistent with what President Obama has argued, and that is this should be a health care bill, not an abortion bill. Let us keep the status quo on the abortion issue. Let this be abortion neutral, to go back to Ellen's phrase earlier. There should be language that's possible to work out. I do want to respond to the caller from New Hampshire, though. I don't think it's right to say that the country has turned more conservative in recent years. Democrats, after all, in the last five elections have won the popular vote. In the last five presidential elections, Democrats have won four times the popular vote. What I do think is fair to say is that, and it's a surprise to me, is that support for the pro-choice position is eroding in national surveys. And it's been I don't quite understand why. I do think it's time for the pro-choice people to launch a more aggressive renewal effort.
Jack, our time is short. Torpedo or some neutrality out there somewhere that might save healthcare reform?
I think they'll have to find that formula because the stakes are just too high. The stakes, by the way, are very high. 40,000 preventable deaths a year in the United States, according to the American Journal of Public Health, because of lack of insurance. Mm.
Jack, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
David Gergen and Ellen Goodman with me in the studio. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.